welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm John Fensterwald, editor-at-large of California's online policy news site, edsource.org, and your moderator for today's program. Since 2009, Arne Duncan has served the Obama administration as the 9th U.S. Secretary of Education. During his tenure, he has led bold, sometimes controversial, initiatives on behalf of America's students from preschool through college, and has been a tireless and passionate advocate for raising standards for all students and for extending opportunities and resources for the nation's most underserved students. He launched billion-dollar competitive grants transform struggling schools, and expand early education. Through his leadership, there have been substantial increases in Pell Grants, enabling more students to attend college, and repayments of those loans have become more manageable and affordable. Secretary Duncan recently announced that in December, he'll step down to return to Chicago, where he once headed the city's public schools and a nonprofit foundation that helps send inner city children to college. We're delighted that he has come to San Francisco to discuss his work and share his insights on the state and the future of America's schools. Welcome, Secretary Duncan. We have some prepared remarks.
Well, thank you so much. I'll try and keep my remarks pretty quick and get to the questions and answers, which I enjoy a lot more. I love weather here in California, love coming out to San Francisco. And if I write a book, I got a new chapter in my book last night. I rode up an elevator with George Zimmer from Men's Warehouse and MC Hammer. It's like, doesn't happen back in DC. A little surreal. And we're all gonna go talk about education reform afterwards. So it was, anyway, good to be out here for lots of reasons, including that addition there. In all seriousness, the work going on here, just met with a number of the court district superintendents, huge fan of what's going on here in San Francisco. Not an easy climate, not enough resources, all kinds of challenges, but the leadership that I'm seeing here is extraordinary. And what the court districts are doing together to focus on social emotional learning, to hold themselves accountable, to understand, yes, kids need to read and write, but we need to help them feel safe and supported. We have to help them grow. Whatever the challenges they are, we got to help them get to the next level. I think the implications to what the core is working on literally are national. Here in San Francisco, graduation rates are up. Mayor supporting more emphasis on technology makes a huge amount of sense. Turning around underperforming schools, which is difficult but hugely important. I remember coming out here a couple years ago, visited Everett Middle School, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. I was given a tour by a girl who was in 8th grade. But she said literally when she was assigned at school, the word she used, she said she was terrified. She was terrified about going to Everett. And just a couple years later with her in 8th grade, that school had a waiting list. Same building, same population, same neighborhood, same socioeconomic challenge. Very different set of leadership, very different set of expectations. And a school that had been a school of last resort was a school that folks really wanted to go to. So just appreciate the hard work. I love the creativity as well. The college savings plan that you have here in San Francisco that the treasurer has done. It's not just the school district getting better, it's the mayor's leadership, it's all the city, but your treasurer, Jose Cisneros, I think he's done an amazing thing to start to get families in kindergarten thinking about saving for college. And for me, the money's nice, it's great, folks invested over $1 million, which is these not wealthy families, but for me, it's really what is it doing for them psychologically? It's starting at the 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 years old to start to say to their children as a family, the goal, the destination is college. And talk about a growth mindset and what that means. Far too often, poor families think college is for rich folks. It's not for them. So it's just really, really fun to see the progress from the core districts, from San Francisco that's part of that team. And we want to continue to do everything we can in the Department of Education to be a good partner for your hard work, your leadership, and your courage. Again, often in a difficult climate. The good news there is in some ways replicated nationally. We announced 2 days ago that we think graduation rates are going to climb again to a new high. Last year, we hit a historic high of 81% graduation rates. What I was most pleased with, we announced that last year, was that literally every subgroups of students were improving. Yes, white students were improving, but black, Latino, Asian American, Native American, English language learners, poor students, students with disabilities. So every single group was improving. That was a huge step in the right direction. Dropout rates are down significantly. African-American dropout rates cut by about 45% over the last decade. Latino cut in half, from 28% to 14%. And rising graduation rates and lower dropout rates has led since 2008 to about 1.1 million additional students of color going on to college. So a lot that we can be proud of, lots of progress. But having said that, I think what drives so many of us in this work is we have so much further to go. And despite graduation rates at historic highs, the number of dropouts, the raw numbers of young people around the nation, it's close to 1 million teenagers every year leaving our schools for our streets. And we know in today's economy, there are just no good jobs out there. Here in San Francisco, my numbers aren't exact, you have about 5,400 ninth graders, you have about 4,400 12th graders. And every district I go to, the number of 12th graders is often dwarfed. Sometimes it's half the number of ninth graders. I keep looking for this district that's stealing all the 10th, 11th, and 12th graders. And I hope to find it, but we know it's not out there. What's stealing our kids are the streets. And they're basically condemned to poverty and social failure. So we have to keep challenging ourselves to accelerate the pace of change. The goal for me is not just college enrollment, which I talked about, that's great. It's college completion. The goal is to get that diploma, not just to go to college. The good news is over the past 20 years, the number of Latinos, young Latinos, 25 to 29-year-olds with college diplomas has doubled. The reality is it's doubled from 8% to 15%. 8% to 15%. Black is 13% to 23%. And so the question for all of us to ask is, do we want to be here 20 years from now in 2035 and say, we are all heroes, we've done a great job, we have doubled again, and now we're at 30%. Or 40% of young people of color with college degrees. And if that is not acceptable to us, as I think it shouldn't be, the question is, how do we accelerate the pace of change and radically improve not just high school graduation rates, not just college enrollment rates, but college completion rates? And just to be clear, and folks in rooms like this understand this, for me, this fight is much bigger than education and educational opportunity, and yes, that's at the heart of this. But this is trying to increase social mobility. This is trying to give folks who have never had a chance in life. This is a fight to end poverty. Some folks say the only way to improve education is to end poverty. I argue the only way to end poverty is to improve educational opportunity, and that when folks have a chance to get a college degree and to go on to life, vast majority of folks are able to do pretty well. This is trying to keep good jobs in our country. In a global economy, a flat world, jobs are gonna go to where the best educated workforce is. And that's either gonna be here, or that's gonna be China, or India, or Singapore, and South Korea. If we want to keep high-wage, high-skilled jobs in this nation, in our communities, in our states, we have to have the best educated workforce. So from a social justice standpoint, from an equity standpoint, from an educational opportunity, from an economic driver, and then the final one I would say, why this is so personal to so many of us, it's really not just about those things, it's really fighting to save kids' lives. And when I grew up on the south side of Chicago and grew up as part of my mother's inner-city tutoring program, there were lots of folks I grew up playing basketball with on the streets who ended up being killed. And when I was a young kid, those kinds of experiences shape you and frankly scar you in a number of ways. And the young people who were lucky enough to be part of my mother's program, who went on to college to be successful, done amazing things, the difference, the dividing line wasn't just educational opportunity. That split was literally life and death. And what was true for me 30, 35, 40 years ago is as true today, and that we have far too many young people, when they don't have opportunity, their lives are cut short. And so the stakes here cannot be higher. Dr. King has this quote, and obviously he's one of my just extraordinary heroes, and for so many of us, he has this quote that I thought about a lot and struggle with. It's, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." The arc of the moral universe is long, and it bends towards justice. And while that is true, and that is encouraging, my two caveats to that is that the arc doesn't bend by itself. It only bends with heroic action and a willingness to challenge the status quo and leadership and courage. And while it has bent and does bend towards justice, I would argue it doesn't bend nearly fast enough in far too many areas. I think it's incumbent upon all of us as leaders to try and bend that arc faster than it has. A couple examples of where I don't think that arc has bent towards justice nearly fast enough is in the space of early childhood education. We know from long-term, longitudinal, 3-4-decade research that when we give children a chance to have high-quality early learning opportunities, that changes their life chances forever. Less teenage pregnancy, less dropouts, less incarceration, more high school graduates, more folks going into the world of work. And yet, as a nation, we deny the vast majority of our four-year-olds a chance to go to high-quality early learning opportunities, which means the average child coming from a poor community starts kindergarten a year to 14 months behind, and frankly, we often don't do a good job of ever catching them up. And lots of folks want to talk about the achievement gap, which I'm happy to talk about. I prefer to talk about the opportunity gap and the fact that the opportunity gap starts so young and we haven't done a better job there is untenable. Second issue of gun violence is one that's very, very personal coming from Chicago, and sadly it's infected communities, not just inner city, but rural and college campuses and shopping malls around our country. But the staggering fact is that we've had more gun deaths since 1970 in the United States than in the entire history of our wars going back to the American Revolution. More citizens killed since 1970 than all of our worlds, all of our wars combined. And then an educational opportunity, far too often today, 2013, 2015, going forward, far too often educational opportunity is determined by zip code, by circumstances of where you were born, rather than seeing education as the great equalizer. And as you look at competitions, you look across the globe, there are counterexamples where in other places the arc has moved towards justice much quicker. In terms of early childhood education, this summer I was briefly in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, every single four-year-old, universal access, every single four-year-old, and right now they're moving towards three-year-olds. Netherlands also moved towards gay marriage a decade before we did, so a couple different lessons there. And the question I constantly get when I talk to folks like that is, how come you guys in the United States don't care about your children, don't care about your babies? And that's a hard question to answer. On the issue of gun violence, my wife is from Tasmania, Australia. 1996, about 20 years ago, they had a horrific massacre, 35 folks killed, actually in her home state. Subsequent to that, they passed some significant gun laws. And since that point, 1996, an entire generation of kids in Australia has grown up without one mass shooting in the entire country. Think what a gift that would be to give to our kids here in the United States. And somehow we've lacked the courage and the leadership to bend that arc towards justice in a better way. Great teachers, and I'll talk about this in a minute, great teachers make a huge difference in students' lives. We don't systemically get those teachers to where they need to be. South Korea does. South Korea pays, incentivizes, and supports and encourages their best talent to go to their poorest communities so that, in fact, if you are born in South Korea and are poor, you are more likely to have a high-performing teacher than if you're born wealthy. So lots of examples of places that have bent that arc faster than us. And just to close, and I'll open up to questions. So for me, it's, you know, how do we get better faster? How do we, yes, celebrate the progress, celebrate what we've done, but if we're here 20 years from now saying we've done great and a third of our Latinos have college degrees and 40% of our African Americans have college degrees, I don't think we'll have a strong nation. I don't think we'll be anywhere close to where we need to be. So just three quick ideas, and we'll open up for questions. One is this idea of just basically expanding educational opportunity. And K-12 has worked pretty well for the past century. I think it's absolutely inadequate for the next century going forward. We have to think about a system pre-K through 14. The Vice President talked earlier this morning about through 16. This idea of having universal access to pre-K, at least through community college, and maybe longer term through all of higher education, that it has to be where we go. And other nations have moved faster than us there. Secondly, technology is going to be a huge driver. I'm a huge fan of that. I think it can drive both equity and excellence. Lots of early work going on there. But at the end of the day, great adults matter. Great teachers matter. Great principals matter. We have not done nearly enough to incentivize great talent to go to the communities that need the most help, be that inner city urban or rural or on Native American reservations. And we have to figure out compensation being a piece of it, but only a piece, but how we make it a badge of honor for our most successful, our most committed teachers and principals to go to the places where the kids need the most help. And our lack of courage and creativity there, I think, is driving this achievement gap. And we have to get much better there. And then the final thing to think about is how we build demand for some of these things and how we create a political climate, regardless who's in who's in office, left, right, Republican, Democrat. Frankly, I could care less on that. And just say at two levels, It's very disturbing to me that with the presidential debates on both sides, education basically isn't a topic that's discussed. And when it is, it's just like mini sound bites. And the question I love every mayor or want to be mayor or governor or folks running for president, the questions you should be asking is, what are you committed to doing in terms of early childhood education, increasing investment? What are your concrete goals to increase graduation rates? What are your goals to reduce dropout rates? What are you going to do to make sure your high school graduates are truly college and career ready? And then what are you going to do to help us lead the world in college graduation rates again? And what resources and political capital are you willing to put behind that effort? And we can have lots of honest debate about the best ways to get to those end goals, but I think those goals are not left or right, Republican or Democrat. Those are goals that make our nation stronger and our community stronger and our family stronger. And I don't blame politicians, to be very clear. I blame us as voters, that we don't insist on having an honest conversation about those things, and we have to do much better there. Secondly, not that sort of at the level of elected officials, secondly, I think we have to grow demand in communities that have been underserved. And I think so much about the civil rights movement and folks who just were tired of being in the back of the bus and were tired of not being allowed to vote. We're tired of not being able to have a seat at a Walgreens Woolworths lunch counter. But somehow, we're not tired of going to schools where 60 and 70% of students drop out. We're not tired of going to schools where kids are 3, 4, 5 grade levels behind. And while folks like me from on top challenge the status quo and we've invested a lot in school turnarounds, what we don't have is enough parents demanding of all of us much better schools for their children. And so how we work both at the grassroots level and also among political leaders to hold all of us accountable for doing more and going faster. The critique I often get is that we're going too fast, and that may be true in some places, and we'll get into it. I honestly think the biggest critique of us collectively, and definitely our administration, is that we're going too slow. We're not getting better fast enough. So how we all accelerate the pace of change so that kids have a chance in life, I think is both the challenge and the opportunity going forward. So thanks so much, and look forward to a great conversation. Thank you.
Glad you talked about the gaps and opportunities as well as just the achievement gap per se. And you laid out an ambitious agenda which requires an increase in investment. We're talking about universal preschool, and the president has called for free community college and to invest in confronting the funding inequities throughout the nation, all require an investment that I wonder whether this Republican Congress, as constituted, and is willing to invest that kind of make that kind of investment, and also post No Child Left Behind, the kind of ambitious policies that you're talking about. So given that, what might be the federal role, Arnie?
So I'll take. Let's talk about investment at the federal level, but also at the state and the local level. The fact that here in California, your per pupil funding is below that of Louisiana is devastating, something we should all be ashamed of. And how that's possible, you know, you all here know the history much better than I, but that makes no sense whatsoever. So in K-12, federal funding is 8 to 10%, usually about half is state, the rest is local. But the fact that Louisiana funds their children, their education more generously than here in California, is untenable. At the federal level, talk about early childhood education, these longitudinal studies, folks a lot smarter than me, James Heckman, a Nobel Prize winning economist, University of Chicago, talks about a 7-to-1 return on investment. For every dollar we invest in early childhood education, we get back $7 in return. So my question to both Democrats and Republicans is, with tax dollars being scarce, how many of those investments you make of taxpayers' resources do you get a 7-to-1 ROI? Very few areas, if any. And so for me, this is not a, you know, R or D issue. It's one that should be we all back. The idea of universal early childhood education wasn't President Obama's idea or my idea. It actually comes from Oklahoma, which is a very conservative state. The idea of the America's College Promise of making community college free wasn't a President Obama idea or Arne Duncan idea. That came from Governor Haslam, who's a good friend but happens to be a strong Republican in Tennessee, who's done remarkable work here. And what they see education is fundamentally is a it's an investment. It's not an expense. Now, having said that, money by itself is never the only answer. We have to hold ourselves accountable for results. We have to turn around dropout factories. We have to challenge the status quo. If early childhood education is not making a difference, it's not just access, it's high quality. The goal is not to go to college, the goal is to graduate. But I think the combination of greater investment and real honest accountability around results for young people, that's where we have to go. And again, the challenge is other nations are doing this. Other nations aren't having these debates. They're not paralyzed. Regardless of which political party is in power, they are making these investments. They have access to universal pre-K. They have access to college. And I just worry from an economic competitiveness standpoint that we won't get there. The final thing I'll say is, you know, so I talk a lot about paying teachers and paying great teachers more for the difference they're making to work in tough communities. That takes a pretty significant investment, so that's not easy. And I laid out an idea a couple weeks ago at the press club back in D.C. that I think mass incarceration in our nation has been a disaster, and for communities, and particularly for communities of color. If we just took 50% of the nonviolent offenders and found alternative routes to locking them up, that would free $15 billion each year. That $15 billion, just a little, you know, quick math problem here, you could take the schools with the highest poverty rates, the 20% of schools with the highest poverty rates, and you could pay every teacher in that school a 50% bonus for working in disadvantaged communities. So not new money, not new tax money, just a different use of resources. And I would much rather bet on great teachers than bet on locking people up for the long haul. I think it's a much better use of our collective resources. So none of this stuff is easy, but if we want to challenge the status quo, we have to think very differently, and there are paths to get there.
You brought up the school to prison pipeline, and which you spoke eloquently about that a couple weeks ago, as you know. And so talk a little bit about the school end of that pipeline, and you talked about the need to examine discipline policies and also have a sort of courageous conversation on race.
So I'll tell you a couple quick stories, and one that I'm not proud of, but I've told it before, so it's not news. But when I started the Chicago Public Schools, I thought too many of our kids were being arrested by the police. So I went to meet with the police chief early on, and said, "You guys are arresting too many of our kids. What can we do differently?" He said, "Well, let me look at the data and get back to you." So I called me, came back in a couple weeks later, and they break their data out by shifts. So they have a shift from 4 o'clock to 12 o'clock at night, a shift from 8 o'clock at night to, from 12 o'clock at night to 8 in the morning, and then from 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. And guess when all the arrests were happening? It was from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the arrests were coming from our schools. And that was just a stunning, gut-wrenching thing. Arrests weren't happening after school, which is what I thought. It wasn't happening at midnight or 2 o'clock. It was our schools calling the police and arresting our kids. So you talk about you've met the enemy and it was us. That's what it was for us. And it was brutal, but that was the truth. That was reality. So we looked at our data. My numbers won't be exact, but about 7% of our schools were leading to 53% of our arrests. And you had schools that were 4 or 5 blocks from each other, same socioeconomic challenges, same neighborhoods, some which literally had no arrests each year, and some which had 120, 130 arrests each year on 180-day school year. That's basically every day a kid was, you know, police were being called. And so we did a lot to train principals differently, and that principals work with each other, and we were able to drive down those rates, not as much as I would have liked, but we drove them down. When I started here, thanks to the civil rights data collection work that our Office of Civil Rights has done, a couple years ago, Attorney General, General Eric Holder and I put out data that this school-to-prison pipeline, suspensions and expulsions, was starting in pre-K. It blew me away. I had no idea. And we were putting out each year thousands of 3- and 4-year-olds. And guess what? Who do you think they were? They're young boys of color. Stunned. I had no idea. So we've tried to be very, very transparent in the data. Sometimes folks don't like when I talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, but it is real. And you've seen in many places people starting to rethink their discipline policies. I give districts and schools, talking about it earlier with the core districts, starting to hold themselves accountable for helping kids who are struggling. If 3- and 4-year-olds having a hard time, it's got to be something we can do to help them other than just shunning them out to the streets. And we've seen in many places those suspensions and expulsions start to go down precipitously. And when we're not expelling and suspending kids, that school-to-prison pipeline starts to go away. So lots of hard work, greater awareness. And I always say when a kid's misbehaving, it's a symptom of a problem. Something's going wrong. And whether they're scared at home or, you know, witnessed something horrific or scared at school or scared in the community,
and where we have restorative justice, where we have peer juries, where we have counselors and social workers who can ask why that child is acting up and what's going on and what's not happening at home and what can we as a community, schools, nonprofits, churches, social service agencies, how can we all put our arms around that child and that family and help them be successful? That's how we stop the school to prison pipeline.
So you talked about teachers, and I think that teachers among us will appreciate the fact that you think that they should be better paid and have better teacher preparation programs as well. And nonetheless, there are many teachers who have felt in the era of No Child Left Behind unappreciated, and they felt that they've been judged harshly by standardized test scores that many experts say shouldn't be used for personnel decisions, at least as a majority of that decision on their evaluation. So, you know, frustrated teachers aren't good marketers for the next generation. And they've been harsh in their criticism of you. So were they overreacting? Were they too defensive? Were they unwilling to change? Or do you think in some ways, some measures, perhaps they're right?
I think these are really complex issues. It's important to cut through the rhetoric on all sides and try and sort of get to the facts. And so I think teachers have absolutely been disrespected. I think teachers have not been paid enough. In South Korea, teachers are known as nation builders. I think teachers here are nation builders, and we should be treating them as that and compensating that and respecting them as such. And so I think there's a lot of work we have to do. The fact that many teachers are working at basically just, you know, poverty levels, can't afford to talk to one teacher who was in North Carolina, who have had precipitous cuts where she was giving blood, giving plasma to pay the bills. Shouldn't have to do that. And, you know, it just doesn't make sense. I think there's much that has been broken with No Child Left Behind, and that's an hour-long topic, and we hoped Congress would have fixed that 6 years ago, but Congress has been broken for a long time, too, and so that's why we've given waivers to 40-something states plus the core districts and tried to move away from the most onerous parts of that. And so I think there's a lot of legitimate, you know, concern and angst amongst hardworking teachers, and I think, you know, I know here today in San Francisco, you announced some efforts to create teacher housing and sort of thinking differently about how we support teachers and build community. We can't do enough of that. Professional development, we can go on and on. Schools of education are often very woefully, inadequately preparing teachers to enter this extraordinarily hard and difficult but important work. So lots of things there. Having said that, I think if we are trying to build a true profession, we cannot divorce teaching from student learning. And the goal of every great teacher is not to teach, is to have their kids learn. And we've never said that the majority of evaluation should be student test scores or anything like that. People like to paint that. I've said lots of silly things. I've never said that. But what we have said is that if you want to build a true profession where you want to respect and reward and compensate excellence, when you want to learn from your best, you have to understand which teachers are making an impact. And this is a little bit of an old analogy. I don't know the exact numbers today, but in the past I talked about there are roughly 300,000 teachers in the state of California. I don't know if that's exact or not. The top 10%, top 30,000 teachers in California are literally world class. Would be as good as teachers anywhere, any nation, anywhere. Your bottom 10% probably should be doing something else. And I don't think there's anyone in California who can tell you who's in that top 10% and who's in the bottom 10%. And I don't know how that serves students well or education well, and more importantly, how it builds a true profession to honor teachers if we're not able to talk about all the different things that make up extraordinary teachers who transform kids' lives. Final thing I'll say, not going too long. For me, it's not about test scores. It's not about whatever. It's about teachers transforming and saving kids' lives. The person who's going to take my spot, John King, my deputy, lost both his parents at a young age. He talks about his teachers in New York City saving his life. That's what this is about. And if we're scared to have that conversation, I don't know how we get to where we need to go as a country.
So you talked about the best 10%. What can be done to get the top teachers in the schools where the most underserved students are?
So first, we have to have imperfect, but we have to have some ways of identifying who that top 10% are. And lots of folks are struggling with that, but we can't just move people and we don't know. I can't look at this room and say we're going to move this 10%. So we have to have some way of figuring out with a comprehensive set of measures, student growth, but leadership and observation and peer observation and principal observation. Survey kids, survey parents. Every single one of us in this room can say which teachers made a huge difference in our lives and which maybe didn't. So that's the starting point to that conversation, is to be willing to identify that talent. And then secondly, what we have to do as a nation is make it the badge of honor to work in disadvantaged communities. And too often, great teachers or not great teachers flee from those communities because they are undercompensated, because it's unsafe, because they're not supported, and go to wealthier communities so the kids that are born with a silver spoon in their mouth get more, and the children born on the wrong side of the tracks get less. So this takes radical rethinking, radical restructuring, but how do you put not just one, but teams of extraordinary teachers into inner city communities, into rural communities, onto tribal communities? Principal leadership matters a lot. You have to have leadership that supports all this. But if we're not willing to put our best talent where it's needed, we'll never get there. Sort of a weird analogy, but I talk about when the president wanted to go get Osama bin Laden, he didn't just get some random folks to do this. He didn't just get some rookies to do this. Who did he send? He sent the Navy SEALs. He sent the best of the best through some measure, imperfectly, I'm sure. The Navy had identified who their most, you know, committed best warriors were, and he sent them to do the hardest work. And that was the badge of honor. And they're risking their lives. That's what we need to, that's the mentality we have to have. We have to send our warriors, our champions, to work with the kids who need the most help.
You know, you mentioned the moral arc is slow to rise. But I think one thing we've seen in the past decade is that one thing that has risen quickly is the decibel level over education. And it seems that it's become quite polarized and ideological and rancorous. You know, you can choose your sides. Charter schools or not, so-called billionaire privatizers of the unions, whether you focus on rising test scores or on the conditions of poverty. And it seems that you pick your side, you pick which one you're on. And so how do you get the conversation so that it isn't polarized and you get some sort of common dialogue where people actually come together and work together on this?
So I think all that is noise that has to do with adult ideology and nothing to do with changing kids' lives. So I just go back to the four questions I asked. What are folks willing to do around early childhood education? What are you willing to do to reduce dropout rates? What are you going to do to increase graduation rates? And what are you going to do to help lead the world in college completion rates? And again, we can have an honest debate about that, but charters versus this, or you know, technical education versus this, that's all noise. It has nothing to do, you know, Common Core versus that. Should we have high standards or not? Are we comfortable with so many students who graduate from high school, going to college, taking remedial classes? Is that okay? Is that good for them? Is that good for taxpayers? And so I think focusing on outcomes and then looking at different methods of trying to get to better outcomes and learning from what works and what doesn't. And no one left or right has a monopoly on good ideas, but it's all what are we doing to help kids be successful. Some charter schools serve 99% poor kids, 95% minority, and have 95% graduation rates, and 95% of graduates go on to college. We need more schools that look like that, whether they're traditional or not. We have other charter schools that are in that dropout factory category I talked about. They need to be closed. Something has to happen there. So there's nothing in the name charter or name traditional or magnet or gifted that's, you know, nobody cares. You know, a 7-year-old doesn't care, doesn't even know what kind of school they go to. Do I have a teacher that cares about me? Do I know my principal? Am I safe? Am I learning? Do I have some good after-school programs? Do I have some access to technology? That's the conversation we need to have. And I think all this other stuff, people build their brands, media loves controversy, but it misses the fact. Who's the urban district that's improving graduation rates the fast enough? Who's the rural district that's improving college completion rate fastest? What's the district where AP participation and success is going up? That's the conversation we need to have. And let's look at the facts. And wherever they lead us, they lead us.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're talking to U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. I'm John Fensterwald, editor-at-large of EdSource, California's online source for education and information, and your moderator today. You mentioned the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, which has been stuck in Congress for going on 8 years, I guess. And we don't know whether it will be reauthorized this year or not. But tell me, from your perspective, what's the minimum that Americans should expect from that reauthorization for the sake of their children?
Well, this law came out in 1965. Yes, it's an education law, but at its heart, it's a civil rights law. And I think we owe it to not just the history and the legacy, but to kids today to maintain that commitment to civil rights. So there are a couple things that are very important to me. Where you have dropout factories, where 40, 50, 60% of students are dropping out every single year, are we going to just admire that problem? Are we just going to label that problem? Or are we going to do something about it? I think it's important we do something about it. I think it's important, we've talked about the bottom 5% of schools, which every city, every state has, so not the 19 out of 20, but the 1 in 20 where it's simply not working for kids. Are we going to do something differently there or not? And we talk about achievement gaps by subgroups, by race. And you can go to, on aggregate, high-performing schools where white kids are here and minority kids are way down here. And are we going to hide behind the aggregate number, or are we going to say this school has to work for every single kid? So at a minimum, we need a law that I think protects the civil rights legacy of helping the kids that need the best educational opportunity to have a chance to enter the middle class and chase the American dream.
So it appears that whatever version of No Child Left Behind or the Elementary and Secondary Education Act comes through and gets to the president will substantially clip back the powers of the Secretary of Education through a reaction of Republicans to some of the incentives you use for Common Core and some Democrats through the administrative use of teacher evaluation. So how would you feel about that, and how would that leave your successor if that's the case?
Well, I think, again, it's important that you have a clear federal role, but it's a limited federal role. And despite what folks think, I think we've tried to really understand what the appropriate federal role is. One is to fight for equity, which is what we talked about. Two is to fight for excellence. And to be clear, we never said the state had to do Common Core or anything about that. We just said states had to have high standards. And we have many states with waivers that aren't part of that coalition. We just think, and the simple benchmark, is that kids who graduate from high school don't have to take remedial classes when they go to college. If folks want to argue we want more people taking remedial classes, we can have that debate, but I think I'll win that one. And to one second behind that, Massachusetts, which by virtually every measure is our highest performing state on lots of metrics, in Massachusetts, 30% of their high school graduates, not their dropouts, 30% have to take remedial classes in college. That's our number one state. So think about 2 through 50. We talk about the cost of college. We're spending billions of dollars each year of families' money, students' money, our taxpayer money, so that folks who graduate from high school can go to college and take more high school classes, non-credit bearing. Doesn't make any sense. So I think at the federal level, we should fight for equity, we should fight for excellence, and we should fight for innovation. And what we haven't done enough in education is get better faster. And one of the things most disturbing, not just on the bill, but in terms of funding, is all the stuff we've done around Promised Neighborhoods and the Invest in Innovation Fund, where there's been massive, massive interest, huge public-private partnerships. Republicans in the House and the Senate zero out those budgets. I think a very appropriate role at the federal level is to foster innovation. And for all the challenges we face, they're being solved somewhere every single day. Again, be it inner city, be it on Native American reservations, what we haven't done in education is scale what works and share best practices. And so again, let's take the politics out of it, let's take the silly stuff out of it, and figure out how we get better faster. That's the debate I would like to have.
Talk a little bit about Common Core. You mentioned that you would think from most of the Republicans running for president who are against it, and yet a recent article in Politico said the battle is actually over. Ask any five-year-old, because most students in America actually are taking the Common Core, maybe under a different name. So where is this resistance come from, and how do you foresee it playing out, the new standards, and why are they important?
Well, again, what folks call them, whatever, is actually irrelevant to me. I just go back to my starting point. is, do we want to continue to have somewhere between 30 and 60, 70% of young people who graduate from high school taking remedial classes in college or not? And if folks are satisfied of where we are, we'll keep doing that and having low standards. And to be clear, we don't set these standards. We ask the local university in that state to just to certify if students are at this bar, they're going to take credit-bearing classes in college. And so I think in most places that's common sense. Politicians like to score points on rhetoric that's irrelevant. And again, I don't blame them. I blame us as voters not bringing them back to what I see as those four core principles. If we could bring the conversation there, we get past the easy sound bites that too often are, you know, give them some, they think, some short-term political advantage, but don't move the country where we need to go.
So part of the resistance is the opt-out movement with regard to the tests for Common Core. And make the case why parents shouldn't opt out of their standardized tests.
So, and again, there's a balance. For me, it's pretty similar to the teacher evaluation where, you know, anything that's 100% based on test scores is a disaster, but anything that says that great teachers shouldn't help students learn, I would say is equally a disaster. There are lots of places where there's too much testing going on. And I've talked about when I led at Chicago Public Schools, we were taking the Illinois state test each year, which made some sense. And for decades, we had also taken the Iowa test of basic skills, which I didn't understand because we didn't live in Iowa. So we stopped taking the Iowa test of basic skills and cut out a huge percent of the testing. And we're continuing to work very hard with states and districts to think about where there is redundancy or duplicative tests or too much time, not just on testing, but teaching to the test. There's great work that the Council of Great City Schools and the Council of State School Chief Officers are doing together. So stay tuned. We're going to do some stuff with them next week on this. And I think we have to find a balance here. And when there's too much time on that and time taken away from instruction and from creativity and learning, then we need to challenge ourselves at every level, state, local, federal. The fact is the vast majority of testing happens at the state and the local level, is not federal. But we have also contributed to that problem. At the end of the day, where it's too much, teachers and kids don't know whether to point a finger at us or the state or the feds. It's too much, and they're right. And so we all need to look in the mirror, figure out how we reduce time on testing, but also make sure that it's efficient and effective. And if you're getting those results back 9 months later or something, that's not helping instruction. But if you're getting data back, not on filling the bubble tests, but on creative thinking and writing and critical thinking, and that data is usable, actionable by teachers and by parents and by children themselves. And a child in fifth grade knows these are my strengths and weaknesses, and this is what I have to do, not just in school, but on after school and weekends and summers to improve. We need to do that. So I think there's a common sense middle ground that we need to get to as a nation. The final thing I'll say is that in all of these things, we have to look also at the common good. And no one probably loves exams. We don't love going to the doctor every single year or going to the dentist, but there's certain things we need to do to maintain our health. The second thing I would say is that if we're serious about equity, if we have folks not taking exams, then we have no way to measure white kids against Latino kids or white kids against Hispanic. We need to be able to look at where we're closing gaps or not closing gaps. So this is a little bit bigger than all of us as parents or as kids. And helping states and districts find a common sense middle ground, making sure we are not contributing to the problem at the federal level. Again, I think it's a very honest conversation and debate to have. And we still have ways to get there, not just on time, but I come back on quality that leads to better instruction and better support.
So the first round of results from, most familiar with Smarter Balanced, showed that the gaps, achievement gaps, between the scores of whites and Asians and African Americans, and particularly English learners, were as wide or wider than under the old California standards test. And so, I think it shows how stubborn and difficult the problem will be, but how much time and how should we measure that progress as we move forward? It's disappointing to a lot of people.
Well, it shouldn't be disappointing. It's the truth. And if we can't handle the truth in education, then we're never going to get there. And I always give the example of Tennessee. My numbers won't be exact, but before Tennessee raised standards, Tennessee was saying something like, in fact, you know, don't know it exact, but fourth grade math, they were saying like 91% of kids were proficient. Sounded pretty good. Mm. They raised standards. They went from about 91% to like 30-something percent. And achievement gaps that were large doubled. But guess what? Tennessee had been lying to its kids and families for a long, long time. And for me, it's one of the most insidious things that happened in education is that we have told kids and families that they're on track to be successful, and they're not even in the game. And so when we raise standards, it might make us uncomfortable, might make us not feel good, but guess what? It's the truth. And we owe it to ourselves, and most importantly, we owe it to our children and their families to be very, very honest that if you want to be successful, the bar is much higher than what we've told you in the past. And we can't just tell them that. We got to give them the supports and the opportunities and the guidance to hit that higher bar. But anyone who thinks that lying to kids, and particularly lying to disadvantaged kids, does them a favor, is unbelievably debilitating and crippling. And so what we have to do is honestly look at these things, and to go back to where I closed, of how do we accelerate the pace of change? And I tried to lay out some ideas behind that. But the fact that folks don't like it, it's the truth. Mm-hmm. It's the truth. Final thing I say about Tennessee is Tennessee, once they raised standards and hit that tough spot, became the fastest improving state in the nation. Gave them a springboard to move forward. And I think added to the sense of urgency. And so this stuff, we can either hide from it, we can deny it, it can paralyze us, or it could create the call to action, sense of urgency we need. I hope that's how folks around the nation respond to telling the truth. But the fact, you know, 2015, in so many states, for decades, we have told kids they're on track to be successful and they're not. Think about that. Think about the implications. Think about the implications for children of color and in disadvantaged communities, what that has meant to their life chances.
I want to get to some questions from our audience. We would keep you here for hours if we could get to all of them, but I can't, my apologies. But there's a common theme, it seems. So why do you emphasize college degrees over skills and apprenticeships that help kids get jobs?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I really don't. I always say some form of learning, some form of education has to be the goal beyond high school. So 4-year universities, 2-year community colleges, trade, technical, vocational training. I should have said that earlier. I try and say that everywhere I go. Just to be clear, without a high school diploma, high school dropout has basically no chance in the legal economy. A high school diploma by itself today, you almost have no chance. So some form of training, and again, that's another phony debate, college versus careers. It's got to be both and, not either or. And today, we're not preparing enough young people for college. We're not preparing enough young people to enter the world of work. And guess what? Actually, the skills are very, very similar between those. So that's another false debate, another distraction, another something that has nothing to do with reality. And we just want to have more kids be able to pursue their dreams, whether that's to be a plumber, and if you paid a plumber lately, they make a lot more than folks in this room, or they want to be an architect, or they want to be the president. We should just give them the skills and the opportunities to pursue their dreams, whatever that might be.
What do you think of the idea of having all-day schools in urban areas where children can do extracurricular activities and there can be professional training as well?
So when I talk about this, sometimes adults cheer and sometimes kids throw tomatoes at me. But essentially what technology is trying to do is move to this, you know, personalized instruction. So rather than teaching to 30 kids, you know, in aggregate, teaching to 30 individual kids their strengths and weaknesses. And I think just the concept of school, what that means, we've been very, very uniform, usually 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year. And for certain kids, that works just fine. And my two children have access to extracurricular sports, and my wife and I can take them to museums and zoos, and that works okay. Not every kid is so lucky. And I think some kids need school 8-9 hours a day. And to be clear, not just school, but access to drama and arts and sports and debate and academic decathlon and robotics and coding clubs or whatever after school. Some kids need 12 hours a day. And there were schools I had in Chicago where we fed kids not one meal a day, but 3 meals a day. And some folks didn't like that, but if the kids aren't hungry, it's hard to learn. We sent a couple thousand kids home on Friday afternoons very quietly with backpacks full of food because they weren't going to eat over the weekend. We had healthcare clinics attached to schools. And so we need to think very differently and, again, much more flexibly, much more creatively about what does each child need. And it's not even school by school or class by class, it's kid by kid. And some kids need 6 hours a day, some need 9 a day, some need 12 a day. I've talked publicly, there are some kids that need 24/7. We need to think about public boarding schools. And not every kid needs that. It's not the right thing for every child. But you sort of look at what's worked for the wealthy in this nation. And when I went to Harvard as an undergrad, I met a lot of folks who had gone to places like Deerfield and Andover and Exeter, and I never heard of these places. And seemed to work pretty well for them for generations. And are there some kids who don't have mom, don't have dad, who don't have grandma, who we need to be thinking about if we're really trying to save their lives? Do they need to be in a 24/7? There are a couple public boarding schools, not a lot. And yes, it costs a lot more money. But again, if we're trying to change kids' lives, we need to think about it. So can we be flexible? Can we have a menu of options and let kids and families figure out what's right for them? And I love the technology, I love the personalization there, but just in hours and support and opportunities, we need a similar level of creativity and innovation there.
Along with that, this is really important in California, which is transitioning to local control, and parent involvement is really key. So the number of folks want to know, what can schools do to get parents more involved in the activities of school as well as their children's lives?
Now, this is huge. I'll say two sides. So I think it's very easy for educators to sort of blame parents for not being involved and for not doing whatever. And for me, half the answer, a big part of the answer is our schools have to be community centers. They have to be open longer hours, and not just for children with academic enrichment and other things, but GED classes for parents and family potlucks and ESL classes and GED and family literacy nights and family counseling. And where schools become truly the hearts of the neighborhood, families will meet us halfway. And you have to think about many families, many parents, they had failure experiences in school. They didn't do well. They weren't supported. And some of us loved going to school. Lots of parents, that just wasn't their experience. It's very intimidating. It can be very cold. So yes, we should challenge parents to do more, but we got to think about how we open up our doors. More and more teachers now are starting to do home visits. What a radical concept. But think what that tells to a parent. Well, you'll come sit in my living room and spend time with me and find out about my challenges. Talked to a teacher who came to our department a couple weeks ago who said he had one parent he couldn't get to do anything. And he's like, that parent's part of the problem. And, you know, he's very, very down on him. Went to the house, found out single mom. She's working three jobs, literally three jobs. That was not a parent that didn't care. That was not, it was a parent that didn't have a minute to spare. And it totally changed his mindset of her and of the child. And so there are lots of things we can do to meet parents half, you know, more than halfway. And I really do believe on the field of dreams, like if we build it, they will come. And we just have to figure out how do our schools become community centers and open not 5 hours a day, you know, 6 hours a day, but open 6-7 days a week, 11-12 hours a day, 11-12 months out of the year. Parents will come. I promise. I've seen it on. They'll come. That's one part. That's the parent involvement, engagement of not just what's in it for their child, but what's in it for them. What kinds of activities can we offer? Not to go on too long, but I always say we have 100,000 schools in our nation. 100,000 schools. Rich neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, black, white, Latino. They all have classrooms. Many have computer labs. They have libraries. They have gyms. Some have pools. They don't belong to me or to the principal or to the union. They belong to the community. They're these amazing community assets. And the fact that we shut down these community assets at 2 and 3 o'clock and sweep kids out into the street where it's not safe, it's mind-boggling to me. So schools can't do this by themselves. They're bringing nonprofits, bringing social service, Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCAs, bringing the churches. We have all these amazing nonprofits who are all struggling. Everyone doesn't have enough money. Get out of the real estate business. Just let them come operate their programs in the schools, give it to them for a dollar, and, you know, just open up the building. So that's one piece that some folks are breaking through, but we could be so much more creative as looking at these physical facilities as assets for the community, not just as traditional schools. The second one that I've struggled with and give myself really low marks on and just need to challenge is how we get parents demanding more of us. And again, that might make some of us uncomfortable, but there are so many kids in so many communities who still today we are poorly serving, and somehow we don't have parents demanding enough of us as educators, and how we build grassroots coalitions, how we have parents hold all of us, local, state, federal, Republican, Democrat, hold us all accountable for giving better results. Not to go on too long, but we talked about the civil rights data collection that we did earlier on the discipline issues of pre-K. We also found, and again, it's just heartbreaking, but it's true, that today in 2015 in the United States, if you go to a predominantly black high school or Latino high school, you have much less chances of having STEM classes that are actually college preparatory. If you go to a more white school, you have much easier progression there. So how are we going to have the next generation of folks who can go into the STEM fields, which is where the jobs are, if we're not offering those classes? But we have to get parents to challenge us, to demand, say it is unacceptable that we have no AP classes, or two AP classes, and this school has 36. Somehow we have to collectively awaken the public to challenge all of us and hold all of us accountable. And I think long term, that will be the force that will change everything, but we're not there yet. I hope we're getting close, but we're not there yet.
To turn to a very different subject of technology, we're in Silicon Valley, and one member of our audience reminds that the White House 4 years ago released a report, Unleashing the Potential of Educational Technology, and wants to know where we are now, what are the obstacles, and how do we get more technology into classrooms?
Yeah, so I'm just very, very hopeful here. We talk about tipping points, and we're not there yet, but we're getting there. So one thing the FCC has done that's just a huge deal, and hopefully folks know this, if not, it's our fault to get the word out, but the FCC is investing billions of dollars over the next couple of years to make sure every school, 99% of schools in the nation, have access to high-speed broadband. And technology can either, you know, drive equity and excellence, or we can have this digital divide that exacerbates the haves and the have-nots. So we have had a set of schools, again, often inner city or rural or remote, tribal communities, that have simply been at a competitive disadvantage, that didn't have the opportunities that more affluent districts have. Well, that playing field is going to start to level. So that's a huge step in the right direction. We're challenging schools and districts to stop buying textbooks and put that money into devices. Never enough money in education, but across the nation, we spend about $8 to $9 billion each year on textbooks that are, I would argue, basically obsolete the day they come to school. And you have a set of districts. I was in a very rural 600-person town not too long ago on the bus trip, where they simply stopped buying textbooks a couple years ago. It's been budget neutral, and every kid has a device. Very rural, lack of resources. So we need to move, you know, in that direction. So there's a chance to move, and again, all of this to me is this idea of kids learning anything they want, anytime, anywhere, and on an individualized basis. And so we're starting to get there with access to high-speed broadband. We need to do more to accelerate access one-to-one devices. Then if we do that, we open up a world of opportunity. And if your high school today doesn't offer AP physics or chemistry, if you can take that online, that's a big deal. Someone like what Saul Khan has done, I'm a huge fan of his, saw him last night, but you know, if you're the poorest kid, you can learn anything you want. My kids do that. Bill Gates' kids do that. Just levels the playing field, equalizes everything. And so I think there's huge potential here. I always want to couple, we need great technology, we need to individualize, personalize instruction, but we also need great teachers and principals. It's not one versus the other. It's both. It's both and, not either or.
The other thing there is plenty of in Silicon Valley is money. And there are a lot of foundations and individuals with wealth investing in their schools. And Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook invested $100 million in Newark with mixed results at best in a book. In fact, a Commonwealth Club talk by Dale Ruskoff a couple weeks ago, pointed that out. So I'm curious, if you had $100 million and you were going back to Chicago, what would you do with it? How would you invest that money?
You know, I was with a number of folks that have a few more dollars than I last night. There was a lot of money in the room last night. And we had this conversation. So there are a couple things. First, I would say none of us have enough money, whether you're Mark Zuckerberg or Lorraine Paul Jobs, whatever, to do this by themselves. So how folks work together, I think, is really important, and get past egos and get past whatever. That's one, just principle. Two, I think it's important to stay with us for the long haul, whatever you choose to do. And if you do something for 2 years and jump to the next thing 2 years, it just doesn't happen that fast. So I'll give you a couple buckets. And then you always try and think, what should the private sector be doing versus what should the public sector be doing? So I'll go back to where I started. Whatever we can do to increase access to high-quality early learning, and there's both public and private sector plays there, that's the best investment we can make. This idea of the America's College promise of making grades 13 and 14 community college free, our estimate is for the state of California, it's about $250 million a year. Sounds like a lot, but private sector could do that tomorrow. Something to think about. How we compensate, reward, get great talent, great teachers and principals to work in disadvantaged communities. A huge play I think the private sector could make there. So there's a number of ways that I think the private sector can play in partnership with each other, leveraging public resources as well to try and change opportunity structure going forward.
So as we wind down, I'd like to have you reflect on the past 7 years and what it's been like in your tenure, how what your achievements and things you may have do-overs, but I'd like to preface this by a quote. You've had a kind of a running conflict with Jerry Brown over the role of federal government in the states. And way back in 2010, when the first rules for Race to the Top were out, he wrote you and said, "There are so many unknowns about what produces educational success that a little humility would be in order." So I guess the question, has the past 8 years made you more humble about what the federal government actually can do from 3,000 miles away to affect change in schools?
So I have tremendous respect for Jerry Brown. I like to think that I came to the federal government with a fair degree of humility.
Okay.
And I'd say beyond humility, real skepticism. And when I ran the Chicago Public Schools for 7.5 years, the federal government wasn't always my friend. And I had to fight the previous administration to give my kids in Chicago the chance to be tutored. About 25,000 kids that needed help after school that the federal government was telling me I couldn't tutor. And I won that fight, and to the credit the previous administration bent and gave in on that. But I had lots of skepticism about what the federal government could do. And had it not been that I had so much respect for President Obama, I would not have taken the job. This was not my dream in life. This was not my aspiration to be Secretary of Education by any stretch. I didn't want to leave Chicago, to be real honest. I just believed in him and wanted to have an impact. So I think the honest question is, what is the appropriate federal role?
Sure.
What can you do? And I'll go back to those three things, those three principles. And we haven't gotten it right every day, and we try to learn and try and work with both urgency and humility. But I'll go back to those three things. We have to fight for equity. We have to fight for the kids who have been the most underserved historically. And whether that's early childhood education, whether that's access to AP classes, whether it's access to higher education, there's a huge equity play. And that's got to be what the federal government does. We have to fight for excellence. So you don't want equity at a low bar. You want equity at a high bar. And so again, whether it's high standards or whatever it might be, I think that's a really appropriate role. And I think we have to fight for innovation. And I look at what folks in the core districts are doing and others around social-emotional learning that I think is going to have national implications. They've done the hard work. They've provided the leadership. They're struggling with it. But I'd like to think the partnership with us has helped to create a little bit of space for that. We've seen huge amounts of work through the Invest in Innovation Fund, the Promise Neighborhood, where communities are doing extraordinary stuff that our resources have helped to facilitate. And again, I always look at, are you selling something people are buying or not? I look at the Invest in Innovation Fund, where routinely we fund one application for about every 30 to 40 we get. And while I'm thrilled to fund that, it kills me that there's so many good ideas out there, just we don't have the resources. What's the federal role? One of my hardest conversations, saddest conversations, was with the governor of Mississippi, Governor Bryant, who desperately, desperately wanted one of our early childhood education grants. And we were able to fund 18, but we had 36 states apply. And unfortunately, they weren't one of the top 18. And if you talk about gaps and lack of opportunity, nowhere is that gap greater than in the state of Mississippi. They're talking about Massachusetts being one, Mississippi is 50th. But Governor Bryant, who might not agree with me on lots of issues, desperately wanted a federal partnership in early childhood education, and we didn't have enough money because the Republican Congress hadn't given us enough money to help Mississippi. So I think that's the conversation we need to have.
So we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one more question, and maybe I can squeeze in two if you speak quickly. And that is, looking back, how would you like to be remembered in a one thing that you would like to be is sort of your legacy, so-called, that you would like people to think of that, and then maybe you answer first. Strategically, if there's one thing you'd like to do over again, what might that be?
So I'm starting to get that question more. I'm just don't give good answers because I just don't think that way. Because it's not about me. It's not about my legacy. It's just I think our job is to fight for kids. And so whether it's increasing access to early childhood education, whether it's driving graduation rates, whether it's $40 billion for Pell Grants to have more young people go to college, first-generation college goers, that's all stuff collectively we're proud of. But in all these things, we have so much further to go. So this is all, you know, clearly from what I know, this is unfinished business. This is not mission accomplished up here. We have a long, long way to go. We need to accelerate the pace of change. So I think our job is to fight for kids. Our job is to fight for more opportunity. And we need to continue to do more there. In terms of things that we just haven't made progress that I see as failures, I talked about gun violence. It is unbelievable to me that we don't value our children, our family's life in this country, unlike in other countries. It's unbelievable to me that we don't have universal access to high-quality early learning. It's unbelievable to me that we don't let undocumented students have the right to go to college. And these are areas where we're basically got someplace between a D or D minus and F. And it's, you know, you never give up. You keep fighting. You keep trying to get better. But those are things that I wish we'd been a lot more successful than we have been.
Thank you. So our thanks to U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan for coming to visit with us. Best of luck in the future pursuits, and thank you for your service to America's children. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio and the internet. I'm John Fensterwald, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.